Today, is this the dawn of a new space race? And Carol Cadwalader recently gave Silicon Valley some home truths, with Mark Zuckerberg in the audience.
And the world waited. July 20th, 1969.
It is said that 500 million people gathered at TV sets around the world to wait for the first Earthling to set foot on the moon. Countless millions more listened on the radio to the voices from the moon.
This is Neil, radio check.
Neil, this is Houston, loud and clear.
In 1969, science writer Philip Ball watched the first moon landing on his TV.
I know that I watched it as an 8-year-old, I guess, because I had and have school books where I drew pictures and wrote in, you know, today men landed on the moon. That's what I was going to be. I was going to be an astronaut. I was determined. That was my future.
After 21 hours and 36 minutes on the moon, a perfect liftoff, and the astronauts are now in lunar orbit, ready to join for the journey home.
The planting of an American flag into the moon's surface marked the end of the political posturing of the space race between the US and the Soviet Union, and it opened up the possibilities of space exploration.
Sooner or later, there will be a manned colony on Mars. And here you see the domes, which will provide the conditions necessary for life. The Russians think there will also have to be huge water towers, possibly pumping water up from far below the surface.
Recently, there has been a stream of rockets and probes leaving the Earth's atmosphere, some heading for the moon, and others even further, leading some people to ask whether a 21st century space race has been triggered. For countries and companies, there is a lot to play for. Military domination, profits, and, if we're very lucky, saving the human race. From The Guardian, I'm India Rekerson. Today in Focus, are we gearing up for a new space race?
The surface appears to be
And what did the planting of that flag in the moon mean?
Yeah, well, this is a huge question. What did it mean? In retrospect, I think it was very clear. It was America saying, we have won the space race.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It was the Cold War context against which the space race was set. And it was very much a concern of particularly the US and Soviet Union at that time of who was going to have dominance in space, because there was a strong feeling that that was where future battles, perhaps even literally, were going to be fought.
So 2019, did you ever think that we'd be here talking about a new space race, a new battle over the moon?
Well, you know, I would imagine that the message we had then was this is the start of something big. And by this time, by the 21st century, there are going to be people living there. You know, that it was going to be routine to go to the moon. And it's a very interesting question why it isn't.
Hello, Neil and Buzz. I'm talking to you by telephone from the Oval Room at the White House. And this certainly has to be the most historic telephone call ever made from the White House.
As you mentioned, all of this was happening as the Cold War unfolded. Was it purely political, or was there also scientific interest?
I feel that there was a real tension at that time between wanting to portray this as a kind of, you know, an expression of the human spirit to explore. There was a big tension between that and the military, you know, Cold War motivations. And my strong suspicion is that without those military motivations, there wouldn't have been enough political will to do this simply for the benefit of mankind. But for scientists, you know, there were opportunities there.
America's just doubled the amount of lunar soil and rock that they expect to bring back.
But that political will to put people on the moon, it didn't actually last very long after that first landing, did it?
It was only 3 years after Neil Armstrong walked on the moon that we saw the last of the Apollo missions. Something that's often overlooked is that when you look at the way human spaceflight was kind of portrayed, certainly in the media before Apollo, it was very utopian. Moon colonies that actually, you know, when you go back and look at them, they were kind of like suburban America transplanted to the moon with a big glass dome over them. And I think it was only when everyone saw those images of this bleak, dark, desolate, dry, barren, inhospitable landscape that the reality sunk in that actually human spaceflight isn't like sailing across the oceans. And you see, that's when you start to see within sort of cultural representations of space flight, much more of a sense of desolation. This was Major Tom. Loneliness, abandonment, and this huge danger.
So we're now in 2019. It's 50 years since the end of the space race. And it perhaps feels like things are kind of hotting up again. What's happening?
There's a lot happening.
Touchdown on the side of the moon humans have yet to examine.
In terms of missions to the moon, there's been a whole spate of them recently. So China has just sent a lander to the moon.
China's lunar probe, Chang'e 4, is carrying two cameras and equipment for biology experiments,
which they say is going to lead in 10 years' time to the establishment of a lunar base that will have astronauts there in it. Israel has just sent a mission that sadly failed to land something on the moon. It crashed.
If at first you don't succeed, you try again. And I want to say it, Tom.
India has one planned that has been long delayed but is likely to take off later this year. And then we have the announcement by Mike Pence.
The first woman and the next man on the moon will both be American astronauts.
That he wants to see Americans walking on the moon again within 5 years.
And surely, as well as scientific endeavours, there are political motivations even within these scientific missions.
Well, I think the announcement by Mike Pence was basically a political one. To my mind, there doesn't seem to be any great virtue in placing this incredibly short and ambitious timescale on getting back to the moon. What's the hurry? Well, really, I think the only hurry is that other nations, India and China in particular, and probably China in particular, are doing it.
I mean, you had Trump launch Space Force.
To establish a Space Force as the sixth branch of the armed forces. That's a big statement.
That sounds non-scientific. Just yes, going to put that out there.
To put it politely, yeah. Well, you know, that was obviously a bit of flag waving, and I haven't come across any scientist, certainly, who takes that seriously. One of the most recent developments has come out of India. India has a very active space program.
Space power ke roop mein darj kara diya hai.
And it, at the end of March, reported that it had been able to destroy one of its own satellites in Earth orbit, sending a missile directed at that satellite to blow it apart. And this was a demonstration of its ability to destroy what it might see as, you know, hostile surveillance satellites. And it's raising fears that space is again going to become militarized, that, you know, if there is a new space race, then it will have this military component. It's also been criticized because the destruction of the satellite, basically it was blown apart. And so you have all that debris now in Earth orbit. depth. So it was a destructive act in many respects. And, you know, certainly it doesn't bode well for the way nations are starting to think about the use of space.
Three, two, one, zero. And launch of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket as NASA turns to the private sector to resupply the International Space Station.
It's not just countries that are trying to get to the moon or get into space, is it?
No, well, this is the really significant thing for how the space race, if we want to call it that, has changed. And it's something that absolutely wasn't foreseen in the days of Apollo, which is that the private sphere has entered the scene. I mean, I guess I feel in some ways this isn't a bad thing. It has always felt to me that it's a bit of a waste of time from a scientific perspective, which is what interests me. Putting, you know, unmanned spacecraft into space is, there's fantastic scientific value in that. But it's never been clear why, you know, at this point in our evolution, we would want to put people in space. And so if you're going to do that, why not leave it to the private companies to figure out how they're going to make a profit from that?
As our beautiful VSS Unity, along with the hopes and dreams of so many, became the first spaceship built for regular passenger service to put humans into space.
Could there be resources on the moon that could be commercialized?
Yeah, well, some people think so. And this is a part of the private enterprise as well, that the mining of space is really, you know, how you want to put it. And this could be mining of resources, mineral resources on the moon, or it could be further afield, and in particular the asteroids, because there are asteroids out there that are particularly rich in metals that are rare on Earth or extremely valuable on Earth. On the moon, it's not clear, you know, we really don't know what resources are there that could be mined for profit in such a difficult, technologically difficult process. Some people have said there's a kind of helium on the moon called helium-3, which is rare on Earth, which could be valuable for a certain type of nuclear fusion. It's very, very tenuous.
Okay.
So when you hear stories of, oh, we're going to go to the moon to mine helium-3, there's not a market for helium-3 at the moment because we don't have those nuclear reactors.
Okay.
And we don't know how much is on the moon.
Hold back on your investment.
So absolutely. Fine.
Okay, so say I wanted to set up my own mine on the moon and I've got all the technology, I've got the plans, I've got the money. Surely there's some sort of law to stop me going up and just sort of drawing out some boundaries and being like, this bit's mine.
It's unclear at the moment. And, you know, this may be tested in the near future. The only really clear international agreement on these sorts of issues was one that was drawn up right back in 1967, at the height of when the space race was really kicking off.
No party will place any nuclear or other weapons of mass destruction in outer space or on a celestial body.
And it's called the Outer Space Treaty.
The moon and other celestial bodies shall be used exclusively for peaceful purposes.
And what it tried to do was to head off precisely this kind of thing. So it states that all the signatories, of which the US and the Soviet Union then were included, would agree that it says the exploration of and the use of space shall be for the benefit of all humankind, and that outer space is not subject to appropriation by claim of national sovereignty.
So there is some space law.
The problem with it was that, of course, it was drawn up with no one thinking that private companies might want to go up and do this. People are now, I think, generally agreed that it's out of date. It's not going to apply anymore. And in fact, it already has been challenged by national legislation. The United States has got national legislation on the use of space for commercial purposes.
This bill encourages the private sector to launch rockets, take risks, and shoot for the stars.
Called the 2015 Space Act, it was drawn up during the Obama administration. And it does say that commercial exploration of space is allowed, basically, that a company like one of these asteroid mining companies, Deep
or
Space Industries,
with my mine. Yeah.
Exactly, could go to certainly to an asteroid and say, this asteroid's now mine, my company's, and I'm going to mine it. And, you know, how this sits with the Outer Space Treaty is simply unclear. They seem to be in conflict. And it's not just the United States. Of all places, Luxembourg, too.
Do they have a big space program?
They don't have a big space program. But, of course, what they do have, what they want to do, is to attract private enterprise. You go to Luxembourg, set up your asteroid mining company, and then you are allowed, according to Luxembourg law, to go and claim an asteroid. So no one really knows what's going to happen.
Who is running these commercial enterprises for space?
A lot of them are set up by Silicon Valley entrepreneurs.
We're building a very large orbital vehicle. We've been working on that for more than 5 years.
Jeff Bezos has his own space tourism company called Blue Origin.
You can't do that with space vehicles that you use once and then throw away.
I mean, you know, we know about Richard Branson with Virgin Galactic.
Hopefully, we'll be able to put quite a few people who are watching this program one day into space.
And then, of course, there's Elon Musk. But he seems to be motivated by what I'm sure he would see at least as a grander vision.
If we're not out there, if the future does not include being out there among the stars and being a multi-planet species, I find that it's incredibly depressing if that's not the future that we're going to have.
So it's not so much about commerce and space tourism and mining places, but simply getting humankind into space. In founding his company SpaceX, which he founded in 2002, he declared that it was a mission to make humankind a spacefaring civilization.
Falcon Heavy is configured for flight.
T-minus 15, standby for terminal count.
And so he's determined that he's going to get a human mission to Mars within our lifetimes.
9, 8, 7.
They have rockets that can go into orbit, and they're actually, one has to say, very impressive rockets.
Yeah. Ignition.
They can go into orbit and land again. The Falcon rocket that did this is the first to have gone up and then come back down and landed vertically.
So Elon Musk's vision is to have human colonies in space on other planets. But I've seen pictures of Mars. It looks really like a crap place to live.
I think that one of the problems with those pictures of Mars, even though they look bleak, they kind of look a bit familiar. You know, they look like a desert on Earth. And so they tempt us to think, well, it's probably a bit like that. Of course, on Mars, it is very, very cold most of the time. There is essentially no air on Mars. So you'd constantly have to be in a spacesuit. And, you know, if anything goes wrong, it's even worse than, you know, anything going wrong in Antarctica. So you're not going to last long. We know that when humans spend any length of time in space in zero gravity, then our bones start to deteriorate. That the bones are only sort of maintained because they need to be, because they're responding to stress, the stress of gravity. Above that, space is full of these things called cosmic rays, and they're really nasty. You don't want to have a strong dose of them. It's like having a strong dose of X-rays, really. It has a similar sort of effect. And they're carcinogenic.
So it sounds like with like Branson and Musk and Trump, I mean, it does sound a bit of a like a lot of boys living out their space fantasy.
Well, this, frankly, is what worries me about it. That, you know, I can't help feeling that, as with so much else that happens in Silicon Valley, you know, it does feel like this is a kind of boys' fantasy of, you know, doing things with really big toys. I think that it still suffers from this same problem that Elon Musk, you know, although he has this vision, he hasn't really articulated why it is that we should all get behind it. What is often said, not just by him, but of course this was what Stephen Hawking used to say about human spaceflight, that we need to do this in order to survive as a race.
We know there is at least one advanced civilization with a propensity for destroying species, ecosystems, atmospheres, and weather patterns, perhaps entire planets. And it happens to live on Earth. Spreading out may be the only thing that saves us from ourselves.
And I think for a lot of people, that smacks of the same kind of attitude that was criticized back in the Apollo times, that it's a diversion from problems on Earth.
Poverty protesters demonstrated quietly outside Mission Control Center, not to decry the astronauts' achievements, but to remind everyone of the unsolved problems here on Earth. Disease and deprivation, ignorance and squalor.
I mean, we have our own problems down here on Earth. So what's the point?
That's what I ask myself, and I haven't yet found anyone who can articulate a good response. Some people will say, well, surely this is what humans have always done. We've always wanted to explore. We've always wanted to go further. I think my concern with that notion is that it seems to portray space as just sort of the next island to sail to. And it's not. It's not only because the scales are so hugely more vast, but it is so empty. And, you know, the notion that somehow we are only going to survive as a species if we colonize the rest of space, at this point, certainly in our evolution, doesn't make any sense. We know that the sun will go out in billions of years of time, but there won't be humans then for sure. You know, we know that there might be other threats here on Earth of nuclear Armageddon and obviously climate change. And
that's
even
an,
if
that's
we
an immediate threat.
Yes, exactly. And even if, you know, we survive that somehow, there's going to be another ice age at some point. You know, there are natural climate changes. The real concerns that we have here are concerns on a timescale of decades. We're not going to be colonizing the moon or Mars on that kind of timescale in any sort of meaningful, sustainable way. So it really is an evasion to think that somehow by doing this, we're going to be saving ourselves from the problems that we face here and now. There was a very nice quote from an American philosopher, really, and ecologist called Lauren Eisley at the time of the Apollo missions, where he said that upon the soaring rockets are projected all the fears and evasions of mankind. And I think that's very, very true, that it feels to me if we can't survive on this planet that has everything we need, we don't have a hope of surviving on Mars.
Philip Ball, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can read more of Philip Ball's work at theguardian.com. Coming up next, the moment Carol Cadwalader told Facebook, Twitter and Google that they'd broken democracy. Now, Observer investigative journalist Carol Cadwalader broke the story of Cambridge Analytica, and she's been probing into the threat to democracy from parts of Silicon Valley. Recently, she delivered a TED Talk, and in the audience were some very familiar faces. Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook, Larry Page and Sergey Brin from Google, and Jack Dorsey from Twitter. And here's what she told them.
About half an hour before I was due to go on stage at TED and give this talk, I was out the back in the backstage area doing kickboxing moves, because this is what somebody had told me. They were like, just do anything that kind of makes you ready for fight. I knew that I was giving this talk to the people who founded and created these platforms.
This technology that you have invented has been amazing, but now it's a crime scene, and you have the evidence. And that is why I am here, to address you directly.
I mean, it was quite an accusation that they broke democracy. It's not about politics. It's about this huge shift change that technology has facilitated, and it can be subverted both by people in Britain and out of Britain, and we've got no idea who they are. our elections now take place on these global tech platforms. And they're beyond the reach of our laws. It's this crazy situation that we are, you know, all of our campaigns and political communications are going via these platforms that are outside Britain and whose CEOs are unaccountable to us. So this is about national security. The system of checks and balances that has developed over several hundred years just no longer works. And so the system of government that has grown up in the West and that has given us all the things which we hold most dear, such as human rights, free speech, they are really, really in danger right now. The referendum is the canary in the coal mine. People don't get it. They think it's about leave and remain when it's really about something much, much scarier than that. Beforehand, I'd been told, look, you're going to have some people in the audience love what you're saying, but you're also going to have, there's also going to be a lot of people there who are very hostile to it. And actually, I was amazed at how few people, it seemed, were hostile to it. And then the other thing about it, which I hadn't realised was kind of quite so controversial, was the fact of naming Zuckerberg and Sandberg and so on.
So my question to you is this what you want? Is this how you want history to remember you? As the handmaidens to authoritarianism that is on the rise all across the world?
You can claim ignorance up to a point, or naivety, but now you can't. Now they know how their platforms are being subverted. Not just to subvert elections, but we also see, obviously, how they're being used to spread hate. You know, how they're being used to inflame ethnic and racial tensions. You know, how it was used in the New Zealand massacre, in Sri Lanka, in Myanmar. And, you know, I just cannot understand how Mark Zuckerberg sleeps at night.
You can read more of Carol's work at theguardian.com. That's all for today. My thanks to Carol Cadwallader and Philip Ball. Today's programme was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Leah Green and Gary Marshall. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier, and today's executive producers are Max Sanderson, Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back with you tomorrow.